First, in addition to our ongoing coverage of the impeachment trial this month, we're also zooming out to talk about the impact of the Trump presidency. It's been easy to get caught up in the daily twists and turns of politics in the Trump era, but our next guest says there's a deeper meaning beneath the turmoil, one that could fundamentally change the role of the presidency. In a new book, he says that President Trump is doing serious damage to the presidency and to American politics, in part by casting aside constitutional and political norms and by treating the executive branch as an expression of his own personality. Benjamin Wittes is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's co-author with Susan Hennessy of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we do see the daily headlines and get caught up in this story and that. But in the book, you say if we step back, we see something emerging, a trend emerging of how President Trump treats the presidency. Big picture, what are you looking at?
So our goal in this book was to take seriously the idea that Donald Trump is proposing a alternative vision of the presidency. Now, that may sound silly because a lot of people hear Trump speak and hear how scattered and all over the place his speech is and how chaotic his management style is. And they say he isn't really proposing anything. But our thesis is that if you look in a serious way at the range of norms that he has violated, if somebody violates this many of our expectations of the office in a fashion that is reasonably consistent over time, it's because whether they even know it or not, they are proposing an alternative. And so our goal in this book was to look at Donald Trump's vision of the presidency and to try to describe it as in as disciplined a fashion as we can and see how it compares and diverges from the traditional presidency. And then finally, to evaluate whether there are aspects of it that are likely to or should have staying power and to critique it and to sort of imagine whether there are parts of this thing that are salutary or whether it is quite as big a disaster as the president's critics certainly imagine it to be.
A lot of times we wonder if a president or any other public official is violating the law. Talk about why we should be focusing on these norms, the things that we're talking about may be legal, but you say we should still be worried about them.
Right. So, you know, normally when we think about the boundaries of presidential power, we think about things that are at the margins of what the president is allowed to do. So Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus on his own authority, right? And that triggered a question about how far the president can go in that regard. And of course, famously, Harry Truman seized the steel mills during the Korean War, triggering a major confrontation with the Supreme Court. These are actions that push the boundaries of presidential power. But what Donald Trump has done is largely stayed within. There are certain things that he's done that raise substantial legal questions, but most of what he does that people think of as abusive is solidly within not the margins of presidential power, but the core of it. So there is no doubt that the president is allowed to fire his FBI director. Even Jim Comey, in being fired, said the president can fire me for any reason or no reason at all. And yet the firing of Jim Comey taking place in the context of an investigation of the people around the president and their relationship to a foreign power raised very profound anxieties. Similarly, there's no doubt that the president can fire the attorney general, and yet removing Jeff Sessions in a retaliation for his having recused himself from the Russia investigation raises very deep questions. So if you look at the range of areas where Donald Trump has challenged our sort of sense of the presidency, they are mostly not at the edges of presidential power. They're mostly within the core of things that he's indisputably allowed to do.
Talking to Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You bring up the concept in the book, you and your co-author, of civic virtue as something that we assume our president will have. Not that all presidents will always be virtuous all the times, but that at least that's going to be part of their DNA. And you worry that it isn't for Donald Trump. Why is that?
So the concept of civic virtue, when we say it now, people kind of roll their eyes, you know, because it's one of those things that we're cynical people. And, you know, we live in a culture that where we don't really believe in a lot of civic virtue anymore. But the founders believed in it very deeply, and they designed a constitution that really doesn't work without it. So if you think about what is the first thing that the president does as president, and the answer is swears an oath, right? And the oath of office, which the founders cared about enough that they actually wrote it into the Constitution, right? It is literally the only place in the Constitution where the document has quotation marks because they wrote a literal script for what the new president is going to say. Now, why did they attach importance to the oath of office? They attached importance to the oath of office because it was a way to require that somebody stand in front of people and promise to do something. You can't make the president force the president to be a good commander in chief, to be wise, to be to faithfully execute the law. But you can make him stand up in front of the population and take an oath to try to do those things. And that is harnessing a sense of honor and a sense of decency and a sense that when a man, and it was then imagined always to be a man and has always been, we should imagine a woman as well, stands up and promises to do something in a solemn occasion like that, he or she will endeavor to do that. Now, one of the things about having somebody like Trump who is sort of proudly unvirtuous, right? I mean, he doesn't just, as many presidents have done, engage in marital infidelities. He boasts of them, right? He doesn't avoid paying taxes. He announces that making sure he doesn't pay taxes makes him smart. And, you know, this is somebody who is proudly non-virtuous. And thus, when he stands up there and takes this oath of office, tens of millions of people around the country watch him do that and say, does he even know what those words mean? And I think this has a very deep effect on our ability to hear presidential speech, to respect the actions of the office of the president when the person occupying it is somebody who's not merely has human failings, but is somebody who's sort of actively rejoicing in his lack of civic virtue.
If I can paraphrase, I think, an argument from President Trump over time, it's that all politicians are corrupt and cynical, but they keep a veneer of this civic virtue out there. President Trump is the same as them, but he's honest about it. And I think that might be part of what his supporters might say is appealing about him. What would you say to that argument?
Well, I would say it's correct. So, you know, Donald Trump is a liar, but one thing he is not a he never lies about, and actually I think he's incapable of hiding, is his own emotional state. And, you know, that comes through to a lot of his supporters as authenticity. And the reason it does is because it is, you know, it is actually authentic. And there are all of these features of what Susan and I call the traditional presidency that Washington looks at with great reverence and sort of traditional politics looks at with great reverence. And one of the things that Donald Trump has revealed is that very large numbers of Americans look at it as hypocrisy and pomp and sort of theater, not as anything substantial or anything that actually reflects virtues of the system. And so I think he has pulled the, you know, the cloth away from our eyes on that, and probably in so doing, whatever damage he may have done, probably did a service.
We're talking to Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Susan Hennessy of the book Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been alarmed by the way President Trump has occupied the office, the White House? Do you see him as an outlier or someone who's really changing the presidency in the future? Do you worry about the precedent he may set for the next president? Or do you think it's a refreshing change of pace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how the Trump presidency differs from those of the past? What worries you, concerns you about the character and tone and management style of President Trump? If you support the president, do any of his behaviors still worry you? Or are there certain norms you're glad to see him changing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hello. I agree with what this author is saying about our president. I think he's, you know, like appealing to the dark side. I don't think that's good. And what kind of example does he set for the youth of America? But what I called for was his statement about the Article 2 of the Constitution. I urge people to read it. It's not very long. Article 2, Section 2, Paragraph 2, says that the president can appoint ambassadors and all this sort of stuff with the consent and approval of the U.S. Senate. And what I wonder about is who in the U.S. Senate gave approval to for Rudy Giuliani and the Secretary of Energy and, you know, the EU ambassador, who approved them? Who gave consent for them to carry out U.S. foreign policy?
Well, thanks for the call, Ben.
So the caller raises a profound question, which is, you know, so one of the issues we treat in the book, and the book was largely written before the Ukraine scandal broke. We wrote a little postscript at the end in response to it. But, you know, one of the issues that's embedded in that question is, you know, this question of how the executive branch is organized. And in a traditional executive branch, you know, the president sits atop a hierarchy that he directs by appointing people and by removing people, but that largely coordinate among themselves, and decisions rise up to the president only that can't be resolved at lower levels. And Trump has so this is what is traditionally called the unitary executive, right? There is only one president, and he appoints the lower officials. Now, one of the things that Trump has done that has been to dramatically disrupt the unitary executive. And part of that is that his management style is deeply chaotic, right? He kind of rules by impulse control issue. But the other factor is that in a way that is really unheard of in the history of the presidency, the lower levels of the federal government just ignore him a lot of the time. So you'll have situations like in the Ukraine scandal where the president directs lower officials not to testify, and a whole lot of them testify anyway, simply defying the president. And then after they do so, they go back to work and they don't get removed, right? There's a whole lot of we cite a lot of examples of this, of people just contradicting the president on matters of policy. And so what the caller is referring to is one aspect of this fracturing of the unitary executive, where you bring in Rudy Giuliani to do the job of the State Department, or you sort of redirect an ambassador to run a policy area, or the energy secretary to run a foreign policy area completely unrelated to what they're supposed to be doing. But another side of that same coin is that often when you tell people to do things, they don't happen. That, You know, we cite a number of instances in the book where the president wants to withdraw from trade agreements, and people in the White House who don't want those things to happen steal documents off his desk, hoping that he'll forget about them. And so, you know, the point works in both directions, right? The executive branch doesn't function in its normal hierarchical fashion, and that means sometimes you have policy chaos with non-executive branch officials like the president's personal lawyer running foreign policy. It also means the normal foreign policy process doesn't work very well.
Thanks, Willem, for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. What are your biggest worries about the potential outcome, even after Donald Trump isn't president anymore, of how this could all change the presidency?
Well, so there are a bunch. The first, and perhaps the most important, is that we are insufficiently committed to these norms to restore them. And I'll give you a very specific example of that. Donald Trump shattered the norm that the president doesn't get to treat the FBI director like any political position. You know, when the president comes in, a new president comes in, he or she replaces the whole cabinet. Traditionally, they do not replace the FBI director, who serves a 10-year term. Trump fired the FBI director he inherited and replaced him. And so one possibility, imagine that the next president is Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, comes in and says, you know, Chris Wray is a nice guy and all, but I want my own FBI director. I would think it would be very hard for anybody to object to them firing Chris Wray and replacing them, say, with a, you know, partisan left-wing Democrat. Now, based on what Donald Trump has done, that would be a defensible thing to do. And yet, if you say, do you want the coercive apparatus of the U.S. federal government to be swinging with party on a regular basis and go to party loyalists of the Democratic or Republican parties, that's a bad direction for that to go. And there are a lot of examples like that, things where he has just violated our expectations of the way presidents behave. And we have to ask the question, do we care enough about those to demand that they shift back? Or are we going to accept, for example, that the next president may have a four-year-long tweet storm that reflects, you know, every change in his or her mood along those 4 years?
And that brings me to another point that I wanted to get to before we run out of time. I guess the view of the executive branch as an expression of the president's personality. That's a theme you return to throughout the book. What do you see there?
Yeah. So I think the most profound level of Trump's vision of the presidency is the merging of the person with the office. And that, you know, we traditionally have this idea that there is the institutional presidency and then there is the person of the president and that those are distinct, right? And so, you know, when Barack Obama plays basketball or George W. Bush goes running, both of which they did regularly, we didn't understand that as an act of the presidency. We understood that as what the guys who happened to be president were doing recreationally or for exercise. Donald Trump has blurred that line very dramatically. When on his Twitter feed, most especially, you often can't tell whether it is the presidency talking or Donald Trump, the person, talking. Did the presidency just hurl insults at a random individual who upset him on television, or is that just a person? And there are in any number of areas, Trump has insisted on the more expressive dimensions of the presidency, sort of sublimating everything else, its traditional management functions, its expectations of public service and kind of good faith execution of the laws. And You know, our basic argument is that this is a very dangerous direction for American politics to go, and the traditional presidency's insistence that these functions and roles are actually distinct and should be distinct is a crucial one to maintain.
Big picture on the violation of norms issue, have we as a political system put too much faith on norms to guide our president when we maybe should have doing more in terms of laws that would, concretely restrict the actions of a president?
So it's a very fair question. And the answer is there are certainly some things that we have relied on norms to regulate that we should probably at this point make policy decisions about and enshrine with law. I see no reason, for example, why it should be up to the president whether to disclose his tax returns. And you can kind of go through a number of areas like that. That said, the presidency is inherently an office of such vast discretion that at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to regulate every possible question in which a deviant personality like Donald Trump's will push lines. And we shouldn't fool ourselves that you can. At some level, you have to rely on things like civic virtue and basic decency to regulate the conduct of the office. And, my basic view is that we should do what we can with the law, but you can't forget that at the end of the day, what holds that office together is an oath and not those laws that we put around it.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's co-author with Susan Hennessy of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Last week, we talked to Victor Davis Hanson, author of the book, The Case for Trump. You can find that conversation at WPR.org/Central Time.